So I actually, I get nervous about doing these kinds of talks. So I wrote it all out in advance. Here it is, and I'm not going to use it because between when I started writing this at the beginning of the week and what I've been experiencing recently, there have been so many changes and so much has been going on that for me, I mean, and not just in the general world. I mean, of course, a lot's been going on in the world. The stuff that the situation in Lafayette Park really got to me. It just sort of took the heart out of me for a while in a certain way, because to me it was real metaphoric for a lot of what's going on around us, and it had a huge impact, more than a lot of other things that were happening. But so this is a time of huge changes, and I was going to actually start my talk with a quotation from Roseanne Cash, of all people, who was writing in The Atlantic, which is one of the magazines I subscribe to. But I decided to do something different. So, hello, Claire. We've not met, but it's nice to sort of see you. I see your mic is muted, so you can't respond, but welcome anyway. Where I wanted to begin is back on the 28th and the 29th of May, when His Holiness did the Avalokiteshvara initiation over the internet. And up until then, I'd been feeling really dubious about how can you possibly do an initiation over the internet. I mean, I'm used to, the Lama is over here. I have to get this right because I'm reversed, right? The Lama is over here, and you're in their presence. And especially with the Dalai Lama, who's usually referred to by the Tibetans as the presence. Dalai Lama is not really a word that's sort of native to Tibetans. The presence, Kundun, is the way they refer to him. So without the presence there, I thought, how is it possible for this to happen? How can you do this sort of thing? And I discovered that wham shabam, it was for real. And we really got the zap. And Kay said, he was around her a lot for the next several days whenever she sat down to meditate. And she observed that I kept falling asleep because it was past my bedtime when this was happening. And then I'd wake up, but I was there, and it was all happening for me. I'd like to think that when I fell asleep, I was sort of more tuned in to the subtle mind of His Holiness rather than just rank unconscious. But anyway, it happened for me too. And so that really turned me around on this particular issue of what's happening on the internet. But it also had strong implications for my thoughts about how are our minds connected. And that is really more my theme for today. I mean, the general place that I'm going to is to talk about altruism, optimism, and the environment. But I have 2 hours to do it, an hour today, or what's left of an hour today, and then also next week. So I'm going to sort of flesh this out fully. And for me, it's good that I don't talk for more than an hour because my voice won't sustain it. Anyway, the other thing that happened was he said, and this was perhaps the most important part of it all, he said, everybody here in this audience, and the audience was a global audience. And he said, by the way, everybody in the audience would be his disciple for lifetimes to come, which was amazingly moving when you think about the fact that he literally had a global audience. I have no idea how many thousands of people attended. The other thing he said was, everybody should teach from their own experience, and that if you taught or communicated your experience of practice to 10 people, and they spoke to 10 people, and they spoke to 10 people, that would obviously be growing geometrically in the way in which there would be an impact. And he didn't say, okay, all you Dharma teachers out there, you should be talking to other people about your practice. And by that, I'm sure he meant your practice now. as it relates to the situation we're in. I mean, I'm sure he meant it generally, but I'm also sure he meant specifically about what's going on now under these unusual circumstances. Circumstances unusual enough that he's doing teachings live stream over the internet. And that was very important for me, because I'd kind of reached the point where I thought I didn't want to do any more Dharma teaching, that my own practice would not support what it was that I was talking about. That I was talking about Madhyamaka, that I was talking about Tantra, and what was my experience? How deep did it go? How could I really share? And he kind of turned me around, because he said, all of you out there who have taken this teaching, who've now taken this initiation into Avalokiteshvara, you have the responsibility to share your experience with other people, that it's needed. And I thought, oh, okay, well, I'm not going to get off the hook. So, okay, I'm stuck. I really thought that this talk might be sort of my swan song. I was sort of looking forward to it, and I guess that's not going to be the case. My wife is chuckling in the background here. She'd been pushing me in this direction for quite a while. By the way, hello, Nancy. I can't see you, but welcome to this little chat that's going on. I was just speaking about His Holiness giving the Avalokiteshvara initiation over the internet a week ago, roughly. So the thing that I really want to talk about is how is it possible to be having these kinds of experiences of, say, taking the Bodhisattva vows with His Holiness via live stream last Thursday night, and getting really turned around by that experience. Zachoje, who is leading the retreat that I'm on, and that's sort of the other thing that's going on for you folks that joined recently, is I'm doing a retreat, a virtual retreat this weekend with one of my lamas, Zachoje Rinpoche. He's in South India. He has students who are doing this all over the world. This is a retreat for Parnishiwara, who's the 20th of the Taras, who specializes in dealing with plagues. And a lot of folks are doing this practice now for obvious reasons. So, okay, so we've all taken the Bodhisattva vows, and we have a certain kind of responsibility to teach from our experience. So that's where I start from. But that creates sort of an immediate problem. And I'll kind of get into my professor mode for a while. So for those that don't know me, I teach Asian religions at a university, and so I get professorial. And it's a little bit complicated for me then to speak from my experience when my tendency is to fall into this kind of professorial attitude of, this is the way it is. I'm telling you how things are, because that's what professors do, when really what I need to be doing and what I hope I'll be doing is sharing my experience, which is a different matter. So for me, the place where everything starts is with the three poisons. I mean, we're all familiar with the three poisons, that the impulses that drive us are attraction, repulsion, and confusion or delusion. Sometimes it's called greed, hate, and ignorance or delusion. And that drives most of everything that we do. That's basic Buddhism. But it's pretty easy to forget that that's what's going on a moment-by-moment, day-by-day basis, especially when we're reflecting on our own experience and reflecting on what we're doing in the world, and if we're reflecting on what we want to do to be helpful in the world, which is what we're supposed to be doing if we've taken the Bodhisattva vows. Because what this means is basically everything we do on the basis of complete and utter delusion. We have no idea what's going on. Really. That's a pretty strange place for a religion to start. But I think if you look around, it's pretty apparent that for the most part, people don't really know what's going on and they don't really know what to do. I read Atlantic Magazine, and there's some really smart people who write for Atlantic Magazine, and they write some really interesting articles. Their hearts are in the right place. They're making great effort. But I think that there's something they deeply miss And that's usually the larger context. And the other thing that they miss is they miss their own sense of their own limitations. So we have a real challenge because we have a responsibility in the world. We have a responsibility to each other, and we're in a state of pretty much complete confusion all of the time. At least as far as I'm concerned, I'm in a state of pretty much complete confusion all of the time. I certainly try and do something about it. That's what my practice is about, of course. But I haven't noticed that my confusion has diminished to a huge amount over the, 50 years of my practice. I mean, that's kind of a terrible thing to say. My wife would say, no, you've changed a whole lot, David, so things have changed. And so maybe I'm just being hard on myself when I feel like I'm not really sure what's going on here. I've thought a lot about the pandemic and other ways of thinking about the pandemic, even in this context of being confused. And I've tried to think about it in a framework which could turn something negative into something positive. Last weekend, Geshe-la talked about seven-point mind training. And mind training is, to a great extent, about taking what is negative and turning it, using an opponent as a teacher, using difficulties, challenges, as ways of developing oneself, of growing. So how can we think about the situation we're in that way? Well, for one thing, what's become apparent to me is that a lot of the stuff, a lot of the vows that I've taken, a lot of the teachings that I've taken, a lot of the beliefs that I have, that have sort of been floating around in the back of my mind, that in some ways I haven't always totally taken totally seriously. Like, you know, if I'm driving down the street and somebody cuts me off, I get angry and I say nasty things about the driver who cut me off. That's not much of a bodhisattva way of driving a vehicle. And given where I live in Santa Fe, there are many opportunities for that particular bodhisattva practice. But, you know, there it is. I lose my temper and say some nasty things, and my wife says, I don't want to hear about this anymore already. Please stop it. So we have these opportunities, but on the larger scale, what's going on with this virus? You know, I mean, one thing that people aren't talking about that's immediately apparent, because we know where this began in a live animal market in Wuhan, in China. If all the humans on the planet were vegetarians, there would be no COVID-19 in our lives. It simply wouldn't have happened. Now, I know it's impossible for everybody to be a vegetarian. My wife is an example of someone that can't be a vegetarian. And biologically, she can't digest vegetable proteins that would keep her going. So we're meat eaters as a result of that. So I'm not preaching when I say this, but there are some realities that are in our face that are environmental realities that we sort of need to be honest about. I mean, the other thing that's happened in the early stages of the lockdown was that people were driving less, there was less pollution, there were less cars on the road, and unusual things started happening. Like, there were wild animals roaming the streets of San Francisco because people weren't out driving around. The air got better. They could see that from satellites in space because the world kind of hit the pause button in a certain way, and the world started cleaning itself up. Well, for the most part, people have forgotten about the fact that that was the case, and we've gone back to business as usual, sort of, even though oil prices have tanked, and there's a lot of people out of work, so there's a lot of industrial activity that's slowed down all over the planet. The point I'm trying to get to here is I think it's possible to see the pandemic as a Dharma teacher. And that turns everything on its head. If you see the pandemic as a Dharma teacher, then you can see forced isolation, if you're a Buddhist anyway, as going into retreat. I mean, that's basically what Kay and I have been doing. because we're both in high risk categories for if we get the coronavirus, we're going to die. Her lungs are compromised. I have problems with my heart. So we're just unbelievably cautious, and that means we've essentially gone into retreat. Yesterday, we went out to a park in Pecos to meet with friends face-to-face because we sat on opposite sides of a picnic table. We were 6 feet apart. That, in over 3 months, is the first time we've had an approximation of direct human contact, except for once when I went to the grocery store because I didn't have the groceries delivered. And when I have the groceries delivered, I say thank you through the window. I don't even meet the person who's delivering the groceries, because it's not just that I'm not wanting to somehow be infected by them. I think it's my responsibility to them to not expose them to me. That's another way of turning everything on its head. A lot of people go around, and I see this in Santa Fe, I'm wearing a mask because I'm afraid of something. I'm afraid of you. Don't get too close to me. Don't breathe on me. And that's not unreal, but apparently masks don't do much to help you not get infected by somebody who might be breathing on you. But what they do is they help prevent the other person from being infected by you. So wearing a mask is actually an altruistic activity. It's really an expression of our bodhisattva attitude. And I try to remember that because I don't like wearing a mask any more than anybody else does. But I try to remember that as part of my practice, right? So part of what I'm sharing here is trying to see the pandemic on its positive side. And I haven't really seen a whole lot of people who've talked about that. I mean, even Zachoji Rinpoche, in talking about the situation we're in and the practices we're doing, hasn't really talked too much about seeing it in its positive side. He has talked a lot about taking the opportunity that's presented, but he hasn't talked about the positive side of the pandemic. And I'm saying there is such a thing, that the pandemic can be a Dharma teacher. And now, hopefully, when I say that, it's just not David being utterly deluded, but having a smidgen of insight into trying to look at things in another kind of way that could be useful. But as I said, I know I'm deluded, so how far can we go here? The other place that I want to go to, and this is again in the framework of the Bodhisattva vow and our responsibilities as people who are on the Bodhisattva path, because again, I'm going to assume that everybody here has taken the Bodhisattva vow. I know some of you have. I don't know if everybody has, but I'll make that assumption. And if you haven't, then you may at some time in the future, so then this will still be relevant, I hope. So in Buddhism, there's conversation about the three doors, or body, speech, and mind. And we practice on the basis of body, speech, and mind. So when you're in isolation, it's a little hard to practice a bodhisattva attitude on the basis of body, unless you go out to the grocery store, for example, or you go take a walk and you run into somebody else, you put your mask on. And I'm saying there's an example. And there are other possible ways that we could practice, even in isolation, on that kind of physical level, you know, thanking the mailman for bringing the mail, but doing it through the window, which he definitely appreciates. He doesn't want to see me up close. And then there's the possibility of practicing from the point of view of speech. And here is something that is really quite amazing. It's the internet. Because actually what's been going on in the Buddhist world is people have been practicing this bodhisattva attitude at the level of speech. I mean, I know we can see each other on Zoom, and then that's relevant, but really what's going on is when we hear each other. In fact, there's research, back into my professorial mode because I teach online, there's research that actually Zoom is very difficult on people who are communicating in that environment, because our minds are attuned to wanting to see all kinds of cues from each other, and you can't see those cues on Zoom. I mean, I shaved before doing this talk, but if I hadn't shaved, you wouldn't know that. You wouldn't be able to see that. There wouldn't be enough detail. And you can't really see what's going on with my eyes unless you have me on full screen and you have a pretty fast connection. So students actually find it tiring to do Zoom instruction. And that's what people at Portland State are saying to their faculty. We're getting tired of this. You know, we really would like to meet with our teachers, which I suspect is not going to be possible in the fall. Who knows? But the research has indicated that it's the sound that really matters. When I took the initiation this morning of Parinashiwari from Tsar Rinpoche, you know, I could barely see him. It was a bad connection, but his voice came in loud and clear. And I've known him for years. I've taken teachings from him. And his voice communicates to me many levels of meaning and contact in the timbre of his voice and so on and so forth. So we have this amazing way that we are engaging in bodhisattva practice at the level of speech. And that's what's going on right now in this gathering. You know, if we have a conversation, we're all doing it, and I hope we'll have some time for questions and conversation before the hour is up. And we only have an hour because then I have to go back on retreat and start doing some practice. So I'm engaging in bodhisattva practice at the level of speech by teaching out of my own experience. And if you do the same with your neighbor, somebody you meet on the street, about how you're using this situation positively rather than negatively as a way of helping to counteract all the fear and the anxiety and the dread and the anger that's going on out there, then you are expressing bodhisattva activity at the level of speech. At least that's my belief. Again, I'm teaching from my own experience. Because I do believe it. I do feel it when I'm doing this. But the real focus of things for me today, and it relates to the rest of the talk about environmentalism, is bodhisattva action from the level of mind. And again, you know, I'm not saying I'm some sort of a special person. Anybody that's taken the bodhisattva vows, who is on the bodhisattva path, by definition, and technically speaking, as you know, the scholars of Buddhism have said, you are a bodhisattva now. You may not feel like it. You may not feel like you're acting like one. You might feel like you could do a lot better, but you are. Okay? So, there you are. So at the level of mind, though, That to me has been the place that I practiced most intensely because I've been in isolation. And it gets to the issue of how is it possible for our lamas to offer blessings, to offer initiation to us at a distance. I mean, it might seem like, well, you know, the Dalai Lama. I mean, yeah, his mind can embrace the whole planet. His mind can embrace the whole world. We can say that in a real cavalier way because he's a bodhisattva, and not just a bodhisattva sort of at our level, but he's the real thing as far as I'm concerned. And we could say, okay, he could do that sort of thing, but I can't do that sort of thing. But you can, because if you're in the receiving end of an initiation, and it's real, if you've opened your heart, if you've opened your mind to that experience, then you don't have to be only on the receiving end, although that can be useful too, because we do practices where we are taking the suffering of others and we're giving blessings to others. But we can also do practices where we are giving blessings to others, where we're directly helping others. Now this, I think, to a lot of people would sound kind of mystical, woo-woo, and whatnot. But I don't take it to be mystical or woo-woo. And maybe the reason for that is, as many of you know, before I got into Vajrayana practice, I was a scholar of Madhyamaka. That's what interested me. I was interested in Nagarjuna. And I started studying and translating Nagarjuna in the 1970s and had the opportunity to do very intensive study with Geshe Sonam Rinchen at the Tibetan Library and with Taratilkhu Rinpoche and took many, attended many lectures, His Holiness did, on Nagarjuna's teachings and on Madhyamaka generally. So that's where I started, but then I moved into Vajrayana practice. So my point is there's a perfectly rational and intellectually comprehensible way of understanding how minds can connect with each other and communicate with each other and influence each other. And that's what I want to talk about now, because that's the place where we can enact bodhisattva mind, not on the basis of irrational faith, but on the basis of practical understanding. Because that's the thing that's so extraordinary about Buddhism, is nothing is on faith. Everything is grounded in logic and practicality if you have the capacity to reach into the theory, understanding, observations, and experiences of those groundings. So that's where I'm going to turn to. I talked earlier about the fact that we're all deluded and we'll get tired of hearing that. But the reason for that is that the fundamental problem that Buddhism understands to be infecting the human condition, to use that sort of language, is something that's usually translated as ignorance. But the Sanskrit for that term, which is much more useful, is avidya. A-vidya. Vidya means to know, and a means not. So what's usually translated as ignorance means not knowing, and it's probably even better translated as misknowing or incorrect knowing. And what is it that's not known correctly? That's the key thing to understand. That's the fundamental and the basic thing that needs to be comprehended in Buddhism. And I picked that word thing somewhat intentionally, because what avidya is about is seeing entities or things where there are no actual entities or things there. I mean, we live in a world where we're surrounded by stuff. I mean, Americans are really good at accumulating stuff. But beyond the fact that we're good at accumulating stuff, we, like everybody else on the planet, sees things around us rather than the reality of what's around us. Now, some people would say the reality of what's around us is a process rather than a thing. That's probably true, but the way our minds work, because of our language, especially if we're English speakers, is our minds see a process as just another thing. We can't help ourselves. We turn everything into a thing. It's called reification. The fundamental Buddhist idea of what is not avidya, what is true understanding, is to recognize that what we're experiencing around us, what we're thinking, our thoughts, our very bodies, and even more importantly, our minds and our consciousness, we experience those, and even the English language forces me to say those, like those things, as things, when upon analysis, according to Madhyamaka, they're not. And if you look closely at any apparent thing, you find it's made up of a lot of parts, which your mind will turn into other things. And as we know from the quantum physicists, they keep going deeper and deeper, looking at more and more things, until they finally get to the point where there are no more things to be seen, but there are relationships of probability. Okay, so that seems like that's not a thing, except for most minds, even probability is yet another thing, because that's the nature of the ignorance of our minds. That's the way in which we're deluded. But the main Buddhist point here is that there is no solid anything anywhere. There is no unity in anything anywhere, even though on a moment-by-moment basis that's what we see. In fact, to exist in this world, that's what we have to see. But that doesn't mean it's real. The other thing is that, there we go again, the other thing, is that everything that exists exists in complex causal relationships. In fact, everything arises in dependence on multiple causes and conditions. Everybody who's been studying Buddhism for a while knows this. But how deeply do we take the reality of it? Well, of course, living with COVID-19, we have to take the reality very deeply, because if you touch a surface that somebody's breathed on too soon, and then, scratch your face, touch your eye because you have a hair in your eye, or whatever, I won't go into some of the other possibilities of what you could be doing with your hand and your face, that's a vehicle for infection, right? So we do exist in dependence on everything around us in a way which now is life and death. What used to be an abstract philosophical, I could walk down the street and I could think about, dependent origination. That's an interesting philosophical concept. I remember going for walks with one of my lamas, Tara Tulku, and he'd be walking along and he would snap his fingers every once in a while. And at one point we finally said, Rinpoche, why are you snapping your fingers? I mean, it didn't seem like there's any good reason. We were in the middle of nowhere, essentially, taking a walk. It was very quiet and he was snapping his fingers. He said, to remind myself of emptiness. It's like turning a mala, you know, like, okay, remember what's really going on here. And because he's in Tsongkhapa's lineage, when he says, remind myself of emptiness, he's also saying, remind myself of dependent origination, because emptiness, dependent origination, two sides of the same thing. They interdepend, okay? Well, these days, we don't need to just walk around snapping our fingers, reminding ourselves about how everything is connected to everything, because if we don't get it right, we get sick. That's an incredible motivation, and it's an incredible opportunity for practicing our understanding of dependent origination. Okay. So our not noticing that is the second reason why we're walking around in a state of confusion. The third reason that we're walking around in a state of confusion is we think that all the characteristics that exist in the things around us, including their very thingness, comes from our side, comes from our minds. And, you know, if we pay attention, we can see that. You know, oh, the chola, that's not really very pretty. I go for walks around here and there's chola every place. And it's stickery, you know, in the wintertime it's kind of dry and desiccated, and when it finally produces some sort of a flower or a fruit, it's kind of measly, you know, it doesn't look like a big deal. I mean, I moved here from Oregon. There's no chola in Oregon. There are towering pines and all this sort of stuff. But what's happened is, I've learned to see the beauty of the chola, and it's become one of the main subjects of my photography, because it's a fascinating plant and it has really profound beauty as far as I'm concerned, and I've now come to see that. So the point is, you know, what I looked at 3 years ago and I found deeply unattractive and repellent because of the spines, I look at now and I find that it's a very beautiful plant. And even the spines have beauty as they shine against the sky when I photograph them and this sort of thing. Same chola, what's changed? Well, my mind has changed. I see it differently, right? So whether or not the chola is attractive or unattractive, that's about me. It's not about the chola. Well, that's a metaphor for everything, you know. The loud cars that go up and down Airport Boulevard here, driven by folks that think loud cars are cool, drive me crazy. It's the same loud car. They think it's just great. You know, I've substituted one muffler for another, and I'm going down the street. this is the coolest thing. And to me, you know, I'm an old codger. I like peace and quiet. It's like, God, that's horrific. Why would anybody do that? Oh, wait a minute. Once upon a time, I was that age, and I pulled the muffler off my motorcycle. Okay. It's not the noise. It's me. I've changed, you know. So, again, another example of something that's obvious. It's what we bring to the experience that makes it what it is. Okay. So much for what's out there. That's the easy stuff. The chola, the loud car, the dependent origination with the virus, the I can't find the end of the unity when I look really closely, it's all made up of parts. What happens when we turn inward and we look at our own minds and the nature of our own consciousness? Now that's when things get kind of extraordinary. And I remember His Holiness writing someplace. I've never been able to find this quotation again, but I know he said it. That when you turn this analysis on the nature of your own mind and consciousness, and I'm going to use these terms interchangeably today, even though often I wouldn't. When you turn the analysis inward on the nature of your own mind, then you make extraordinary progress. Those are his words, not mine. Why is that? What happens? Well, we don't think about this very much, but what do we think about the nature of our minds, about the nature of our consciousness? We think of them as being unitary. Like, I've just got this consciousness, it's me. Well, is that true? If we look closely, what do we find? Oh, well, it's just always there. Well, maybe. Does it depend on something? Well, technically, the Buddhists would say, yeah, it depends upon the previous moment of consciousness. But the story is actually more complicated than that, because consciousness always arises in relationship to an object, even if consciousness happens to be the object that consciousness is arising in relationship to. This could get really fiendishly complex. That's not quite where I'm going to go right now, although I could. There's some very interesting stuff there. But the point is that that which we know most closely, which is our own awareness, we're pretty confused about. And the other thing is, we have a lot of notions about the nature of our own consciousness that come out of our culture, that come out of our society, that come out of our education. Are those things true? How do we know those things are true? There's a very interesting book out called, actually let me grab it here. It's called Waking, Dreaming, and Being by Evan Thompson. He's a philosophy professor at the University of British Columbia. He had the good fortune of being raised by extraordinary parents in extraordinary situations, or in extraordinary situations. And he's a Buddhist philosopher, although he claims not to, because he survives in a straight analytic philosophy department, University of British Columbia. But he's done extraordinary writing about Buddhist concepts like clear light mind, non-Buddhist ideas about consciousness, and so on. One of the main points that he comes to is that the problem with our understanding, like from a Western point of view, the scientific problem with understanding consciousness, even if you're doing things like electroencephalogram studies, is we can never step outside of consciousness to look at consciousness. And there are some deep scientific and philosophical problems that are associated with that, and he explores those. So I recommend the book to you. It's a very intriguing book. I have my students read it in my environmental philosophy, in my Asian philosophy class. If we can't step out outside of consciousness to know consciousness, then the fundamental scientific process of subject knowing object in observable and repeated ways with a certain kind of distance and whatnot, that doesn't work for understanding consciousness. But from the point of view of what we're talking about here, what this means to me is that even though my awareness is the thing that I'm most interested in, that I'm closest to, which is there when I wake up in the morning, and unfortunately too frequently is there when I'd like to sleep through the night, is something that in a fundamental way I can only know so much about, and that I can't know fully, and that I have a lot of fictive ideas about. And one of the fictive ideas that is really important to me is that I think that my consciousness has certain limits. I impose the idea of self, which is this fundamental misknowing of creating things, entities, are technically called selves in Buddhist language. I won't go into the technical terminology in either Sanskrit or Tibetan. But the self is something that we project onto everything. That's the thing we see everywhere. We see it in our own consciousness, in our own mind. So we imagine, we fantasize, we are confused about the nature of our own awareness. We think it has certain kinds of limits, but we have no way of knowing if those things are the limits of our mind. We just assume they are. I assume that when I get pissed off at the guy with a loud car who just cut me off on the corner of Airport and South Meadows, and I'm swearing under my breath, that he doesn't know that that's going on, that he doesn't experience that. I assume he doesn't. Why do I make that assumption? Why do I make the assumption that he doesn't experience my anger? If His Holiness can do an initiation in Dharamsala and I'm in Santa Fe and I experience something in that initiation, if my mind meets his in that initiation, why isn't my mind meeting the mind of the driver on Airport Road that cut me off at South Meadows? It's just an assumption on my part. I don't have any way to prove it's happening, and I don't have any way to prove it's not happening. It's completely uncertain. Since I can't prove it's happening, I could give myself many excuses for not controlling my mind. But since I can't prove it's not happening, I have an equal number of reasons for controlling my mind. And better still, I have even more reasons for sitting down and doing something with my mind that might have a positive impact on the environment around me. If I sit down and do any of the mind training exercises, any of the Tonglin, any of the Lojong, any of that stuff, I might think, oh, really, I know, it's only for me. It's only improving my mind. And there's nothing wrong with that. But why do I believe that it's not having an impact on the people around me? That's just an assumption. I can't prove it is, and I also can't prove it isn't. So why wouldn't I take advantage of that situation, especially when I'm in isolation, and think, okay, when I'm doing my meditation practices, which are giving me some peace of mind to cope with the stress that I feel all around me, and by the way, I do feel it all around me, I'm empathic. I can feel this stuff in my mind, in my body, in my heart. So I'm practicing to deal with it. Why can't I also be practicing with the attitude that if I'm dealing with it, and if I'm calming my mind down, in some way that has an effect on all the minds around, and I'm calming them down. Now maybe it's only a little bit. You know, if a drop of rain falls in the ocean is now fractionally a little bit higher than it was before that drop of rain fell in the ocean. I mean, it may be unmeasurable, it may be almost incomprehensible, but in fact, it is different. That drop of water, that drop of rain in the ocean did fundamentally make a difference. And of course, if a huge storm were to fall in the water, the ocean would rise a lot. I mean, what did we experience with Superstorm Sandy? You know, the concatenation of high tides, a lot of rainfall and winds, and it basically paralyzed New York. So what would happen if all the Dharma students on the planet and all the monks on the planet all got together at the same time and started thinking positive thoughts about what's going on? That would be like a phenomenal rainstorm raising the level of the ocean. So what happened a week ago when His Holiness did this initiation? What happened Thursday night when he led, I have no idea how many thousands of people, in taking the Bodhisattva vows? It was like this incredible rainstorm in the collective psyche, as far as I'm concerned. It was like thunder and lightning, megastorm Sandy in the collective mind of the planet, with all these people participating and generating some positive thoughts. I mean, there's plenty of negative thoughts out there. There's plenty of fear out there. So here's an opportunity for all of us to get together and do something positive. On Tuesday nights, when we can get our act together, we meet with Charmaine and we meditate Green Tara, or we meditate Healing Buddha. And, okay, it's a half a dozen minds that get together. But that's a half a dozen minds that are doing something positive in the collective mental space, if you believe that your mind is not limited in the way you think it is. And you can't prove it's not, and you can't prove it is. So why not make the assumption that it is? Now, I prefer to believe my experience with His Holiness, that whether I'm with Him in an auditorium with 5,000 people receiving an initiation, or I'm sitting across from him in his, in his reception room in Dharamsala, or he's on the other side of the planet, I prefer to believe that I still experience the benevolent qualities of his mind. And I prefer to believe that because that's been my experience. And he said, speak from your own experience. So that's what I want to share with you, that we can all practice in that way. And that's a good place to begin our practice as we experience this unprecedented situation in the world. I mean, there have been plagues before. So I'm a scholar. I've studied a lot of history. I know more about the Black Death of the 14th century than you ever want to hear, believe me. And I know that it was caused by an early version of globalization, which is interesting. I mean, the reason that Black Death happened in Europe was because the Mongol conquest that united Eurasia and made it possible for critters coming from China, interestingly, to end up in Europe to infect Europe and reduce the population by a third. That's scarifying information. So there have been pandemics before, but this one's unique because this one literally is over the whole globe. That's never happened before. And at the same time that that's happening on the physical level, we have the internet where we're communicating and relating to each other globally for the first time at the same time this is happening. And now I'm saying we can do this at the level of mind if we turn ourselves to it. And in fact, I should. And maybe you could, or maybe you should also. I hate to say you should do anything, but you might want to, because you might find that it gives you a lot of peace. It gives me a lot of peace. So that's where I'd like to end today's session. And I'll come back to that in greater detail and with larger perspective. I promise not to talk about the Black Death or Lafayette Square or any of that kind of stuff, because I want to keep this as a what can we do that's beneficial for the larger environment and what's going on in the larger environment.